3 seconds for a national championship or overtime. Ogunbowale for the win. Good! Arike Ogunbowale wins the national championship for Notre Dame.
Bulls are out of timeouts. 2 seconds left. Giddy for the win. Go!
Oh my God! I cannot believe this. Elizabeth, I'm coming, baby.
And that is one of the up-and-coming play-by-play voices in the sports media industry, Adam Amin, who is the guest on the latest edition of the Sports Media Watch podcast. I'm John Lewis, and in a moment, my co-host Armand Brody, producer Derek Futterman, and I will be joined by Adam Amin for a discussion about his career, his influences, his technique, his partners, including, of course, Stacey King in Chicago, and his memorable call at the end of the recent Mariners-Tigers American League Division Series Game 5. Earlier this month. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. It's another special edition of the Sports Media Watch podcast. But before we get to that, don't forget, if you have not already, please subscribe to the SMW podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. That's where you can hear past interviews with voices like Kevin Harlan, Ian Eagle, James Brown, Mike Greenberg, executives like Rick Cordella, and future interviews. Because remember, we still have Michael Grady. I know I've been promising you Michael Grady for a while. We have Michael Grady coming up. We have Jared Greenberg coming up. And more interviews in the pipeline as well. All right. With no further ado, let's get straight to the interview. Well, we are very happy to be joined by one of the rising stars in sports business. We're talking about one of the prominent voices of MLB on Fox, NFL on Fox, and the voice of the Chicago Bulls on Chicago Sports Network. We are joined by Adam Amin. And Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And what I have to imagine is kind of a breather. We were taping Monday. You did the NFL on Fox Sunday. You're going to be doing the start of the Bulls season, and you just came off of MLB. So what is this time of year like for you, one? And two, when will we see you on the Blackhawks as well, working that in?
Appreciate you guys having me. It's very much a fun conversation to have anytime I get a chance to talk with you guys. But I will not be doing any Blackhawks hockey. Somebody asked me many years ago, will you do some Blackhawks games? I said, I know my limits. And that's a very specific skill set that I save that for the Rick Balls and the Kenny Alberts and the Brendan Burks and all the great hockey voices, the McDonoughs and the Wishusens of the world that are doing it. They're very, very, very good. It's very entertaining to watch them do it. I'm not there yet. I don't think I'll ever really have the skill for it. But this is a little bit of a breather. I'm looking at my calendar. I'm in my office right now, and there's one game on Wednesday, which is the Bulls home opener. We have a Carolina-Buffalo game on Sunday, and then things pick up because now you get into the heart of the NBA schedule. There's a 3-game week next week. So I'll do, they all happen to be at home. So I'll have a Bulls game on a Monday, a Wednesday, a Friday, travel on Saturday, do whatever my NFL game is that Sunday. And then I think we're traveling to Berlin. The NFL has all these international games. They're doing a game in Berlin. They're doing a game in Madrid, which may end up being one of my assignments. I'm not sure yet. We'll probably find out later this week. But yeah, it's going to pick up very, very fast. So this last week, with just one basketball game, one football game, honestly does feel like a little bit of a breather right now.
For that Berlin game, is that going to be a first for you? Have you ever done any of those international games for the NFL?
Not the NFL, no. This is the first time. So very much looking forward to doing something historic. I know, you know, I talked to a couple of friends. I was working with Greg Olson this past week. He had a fun experience in Dublin. And you know, Rich Eisen and Kurt Warner have worked with some of the members of one of our production crews at Fox, because Fox is doing like a lot, you know, they're using a lot of the Fox crews to do these international games this year. They've used CBS in the past. So a lot of people are getting some really cool experiences out in Europe doing this stuff.
Adam, what's it been like juggling national work and local work? And it's almost like you have to sort of use two different approaches as a broadcaster. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. Just sort of walk us through how you think when you're doing a game on Fox versus one for the Bulls.
No, AB, you're absolutely right. There is a different, slightly different approach. I think the preparation is certainly different because you're trying to be as all-encompassing as possible on a week-to-week basis with like an NFL game. You're trying to catch up to everything that's taken place over the course of the year, but you can really center everything on that game. The preparation for the NBA gets very into the weeds because you're getting very specific about certain tendencies that the team that you're covering may have, but you also have to be able to relate it to the stuff that happened the first week or the third month or the 24th game or whatever it may be. You're constantly trying to connect these dots. Whereas you speak a little bit more broadly, I think on the national side of things, you are introducing a team in a lot of ways to an opposing fan base, perhaps. Like, we just came off Philadelphia, Minnesota. Carson Wentz is starting for Minnesota. So obviously all the Vikings fans know that. They've gotten used to it the last three games. But for Philadelphia fans, well, hey, I remember Carson. He was the quarterback for the Eagles for 5 years. What's he been up to lately? You know, they might not have run into him. He'd only played against him once, and that was 3 years ago. So you're allowed to kind of keep things a little bit more broad, but it is always good. And I think this is where preparation is so important for myself, for whoever I work with partner-wise, for any play-by-play announcer, any color analyst that's doing games, any reporter that's covering a team. You're trying to be as thorough as possible in your research, but you're trying to deliver it in a simpler fashion with context and background behind what you're saying. And always using a specific example helps. That just gives fans a better kind of understanding contextually for what's going on. And the calls themselves, like when we're doing an NFL on Fox game, we're doing MLB on Fox, like I get excited more so for the moment itself. You know, like the moment is going to be the biggest thing. I certainly call a baseball game differently if a road team does something or a home team does something, just because you have 40,000 extra voices helping you out on a home call. It's a little more silent on the road call. You know, I asked broadcasters I respect, Brian Anderson being among them. I asked him if he had any advice. He goes, hey, if the road team does something, hit the call, give it a layer or two, and then back off and see the reaction. Whereas obviously all of us have always kind of followed the home team does something big, punch the call, get out of the way, let the crowd, let the pictures tell the story. So when it's the Bulls, like, it's very clear. We want the Bulls to win. We want them to do well. It's more fun for us. It's more fun for the fan base that's watching, that's more specifically Bulls fans. But I think we also approach the game when we do a local broadcast from the thought process of, I want to be as informed as possible on the road team because we want to give respect to the opposing team. And that comes from being a national broadcaster for the last 15 years or whatever it's been.
On that subject of the differences, I'm curious, do you have a different approach to when you're doing the Bulls? You're working with Stacey King. He's one of the most colorful analysts that there is. So you don't get to lay out the same way. On the Josh Giddey three-pointer last year, Stacey King is going, he's doing a full, what was it now?
The Sanford and Son,
yes,
the famous
you.
Sanford and Son reference. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. He's doing full Fred Sanford. How different is that, obviously, from when you're doing a national game, the analyst is stepping out of your way?
I think Stacey is who he is, and he is truly one of one. He is a one of one broadcaster in my estimation right now. And there are plenty of great analysts. I think Stacey is a great basketball analyst. I think sometimes that gets lost in the exuberance and the fun that we have, but he is a really good basketball analyst. There are a lot of really good basketball analysts on TV. There are some very entertaining people who do this job, especially in the analyst position around the league. I'm fortunate that I have somebody next to me that is both a great analyst, really entertaining, really funny. He's always had the gift of gab. Like, that's just how he's been that way for the last, probably his entire life, but certainly since I've kind of been familiar with his work going back to his days as a player in Oklahoma, you know, watching interviews, like he was always like a charming, funny person. He happens to be the full package, but he has this way about him that very much models like Dick Vitale. Dick Vitale called a lot of Stacey's games because he was at a really good program in Oklahoma in the 1980s. And he was I don't think people know, he was like a journalism student at Oklahoma as well. Like, that's the other thing about Stace that sometimes people don't realize. Like, he studied this stuff and he watched Dick Vitale and he loved how Dick called college basketball games. And I think there's a whole generation, maybe a couple of generations of fans who watched or listened to Dick Vitale. There are probably some basketball players that said, if I ever got a chance to do TV, I would want to do it like that. He's having more fun than anybody in the building right now. Why wouldn't I want to be like that? So that's who he's always kind of modeled himself after. And I've worked with Dick Vitale and probably, I think it was about 10 years ago, I worked with him a couple of times. I remember talking to Dan Shulman, the great Toronto Blue Jays voice and ESPN college basketball voice, about working with Dick. And he said, you can't cage the bird. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you can't limit what this personality, this exuberance does for a fan base. Fans love what Stacey does. So my thought, as soon as I got this job, the second I started filling in 7 years ago, I thought, I do not want to step on this guy's toes. I want him to be who he is. I never want him to worry that I'm going to try to overtake a broadcast. I know who he is. I grew up watching him. So I already have this familiarity with his style, with him. I was a fan. So for me to get the chance to work with him, I always thought, well, I'm going to make sure I do what Neil Funk did, because Neil was a great straight man to Stacey. And I have a different style than Neil, and that's okay. And I have different reference points than Neil, and that is part of what makes doing the broadcast with Stacey so fun. But I think you have to let him be who he is. You know, like, I, not to get too lyrical about it, but like, one of my favorite books is To Kill a Mockingbird. And there's this line in there that says, it's a sin to kill a mockingbird because all they do is sing and make people happy. And it's like a broadcast sin to me to try to silence my partner and silence my friend by telling him, like, hey, back off here. No, like, I'm going to punch the call. I'm going to get out of the way. Whatever this man has, I'm going to let him enjoy it, bring it to people that have gotten used to it, and then I'll pick it up and tag it or let it breathe a little longer, whatever is required of me in that moment. Sometimes our calls overlap each other or pick up from each other. Like, DeMar DeRozan had a game tying shot a couple of years ago in Indiana, not the game winner, but the game tying shot. And he said, DeMarvelous DeRozan. And he looked at me and I said, does it again. We picked it up right off of each other. And that's a chemistry that has been there since day one. And I know this is a very, very long answer, guys, but like, it's fun to be able to talk about the thought process when it comes to working with unique individuals and talented people like Stace.
So why don't we talk about the most recent call that you had? Obviously, one of the best calls, one of the best games you've ever worked in your career. So I'm going to ask you two questions. One, we'll start with the length of the game. This is a 15-inning game. It's obviously, what is it like to go 5+ hours doing a baseball game? And then that final play. One, how did you keep your energy up throughout? Because that was something a lot of people noticed. You had a lot of energy deep into the late innings of that game, when a lot of people probably were dozing off watching it. And then just run me through that final call as well.
I don't think I need to generate energy when I'm on the air. I think I really love doing this. I think all day I was like jacked up to do the game. I was really excited. I mean, obviously, like, I had never done a game five. I've been doing the division series since 2020. And none of our series had ever gone to a game five. We had a sweep in 2020. I think the next 4 years were all 4-game series. And we finally got a deciding game five. And I hadn't called a game five since my first year as the voice of the Somerset Patriots in New Jersey in the Atlantic League in 2010. We did a playoff series that went 5 games. And I remember how fun that was. It ended up being like a 1-0 game too. It was a 1-run game. And I just remember how exciting that was. And I was so like adamant that I was going to keep my focus. I was going to stay locked in. And that's the mentality you have to take into most broadcasts. But you don't necessarily do that in a way for game number 25 in the NBA season. Not because it doesn't deserve it. It's because it doesn't feel like it's the same appropriateness for it. It's not, you know, this has very high stakes to it. And I don't think you can overblow the stakes. But if I do a regular season NBA game or a regular season baseball game that goes a little longer, like, you still have to give it the appropriate feel. Like, this is fun. This is a good time. But let's remember, like, this is 1 out of 82 or 1 out of 162. That's why the NFL is so intense, because there's only 17 games. With these other sports, these long seasons, you still have to remember that it's 1 out of 162. It's not the season. This is the season. This is everything for these teams. This is, as we said many times, a winner take all game. So I wanted to make sure I was energized. I wanted to make sure I was dialed in. I had a lot of texts and a lot of phone calls from people I respect, people I love, people I appreciate, and all of them were encouraging and excited for me, excited for our crew. They were like, I can't wait to watch. I know it's going to be fun. The atmosphere in Seattle and Detroit were, you know, the two atmospheres were tremendous. Seattle, as most of the country is learning now, is maybe one of the 5 best atmospheres in all of Major League Baseball. And along with that is, like, I've always been energetic once I'm on the air. No matter what else is happening, I try to bring energy to the game because that's the fun time. The preparation can be tedious. The preparation can be intense sometimes, just in terms of depth or volume, not necessarily like by, you know, effort of work, but like just it gets mentally taxing sometimes to make sure you have this story or that anecdote or this statistic or this nugget or this setup. The energy once the game starts is there. So I didn't drink any caffeine after like noon. I think that day, I think I had a cup of coffee at noon and that was about it. Like I didn't feel like I had to wake myself up or anything like that. It's just the game itself, the passion of the fans, the atmosphere, everybody on our crew felt like it, to me, it felt like they were all dialed in and that feeds into it. You know, everybody was feeling good during the course of that broadcast. My partners were, Tom Verducci was, the crew was. So I think the game itself has a lot to do with keeping the energy up. And I think naturally I like to be an energetic person when it comes to being on the air. But we also know at the end, like you guys were talking about, all I wanted to do is make sure you nail the final call. I think we did a good job of catching all these moments and setting up big moments. I was really proud of how our crew did the Leo Rivas moment in the seventh inning because we got to tell his story and talk about how he toiled in the minor leagues and just hit the biggest hit of his entire life on his birthday. We were really proud of that.
So here's Rivas, who hit his first two major league home runs in September, including a walk-off. Tying run at second. Go ahead, run at first. And Rivas will take strike one. A 27-year-old from Venezuela. In fact, turned 28 years old today. Typically good for a quality at bat. 9 years in the minor leagues before debuting in the majors this year. And he lines one in the left field. Base hit. Here comes Polanco. Leo Rivas off the bench. Ties the game. Leo Rivas, who toiled through almost 700 minor league games for the opportunity to step up in the postseason with the biggest swing he's ever taken in his 28 years on earth. Happy birthday, Rivas. Tie game five.
But you get to extra innings, you're like, every moment is big. That's why like the energy on the double plays is high. Because if they don't turn those double plays, the season's over for the Tigers. And the Mariners are going to have a walk-off and we're going to get to call that moment and we're going to bring energy to that moment. If it's Seattle winning or Detroit making a great play, and then in the 15th inning, it's building. Like, Canely's struggling a little bit. The changeup is missing. He's hit a batter. He's walked a guy, whatever it is. And now the bases are loaded. Anything can happen. A pitch can get away. A guy can get hit. And the season is over for one of those teams. And if it's Seattle winning, they're doing something they haven't done in a quarter century. So I made sure that no matter what, if it's Polanco hitting a grand slam, if it's a hit by pitch, if it's a wild pitch, I wrote down in my scorecard, 24 years ALCS. It's like, just don't forget that you have to say these things. That's a Howie Rose lesson that he taught to Wayne Randazzo. He said, you know, Michael Kay has always done that. He's like, whatever historic moment I'm calling, let me hit the number, make sure I punch this and then get out of the way. And that's how we wanted to approach that. And we got it. We got a Polanco base hit, sends it into right, sends Seattle to the ALCS, first time in 24 years. And then I think we all went silent for something like 2 minutes.
Skyline's new chicken chili is here. Now you can enjoy that legendary Skyline taste with a new protein option. Try Skyline's chicken chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. Feeling good. It's Skyline time.
That was the longest winner-take-all game in Major League Baseball's postseason history, 4 hours and 58 minutes long. Less than 2 days later, you're at Bank of America Stadium calling the Cowboys against the Panthers in another game that ended on a walk-off field goal. Can you kind of talk about what it was like after the Jorge Polanco walk-off was all said and done, and then being able to suddenly turn around to do an NFL game 2 days later?
We were a little sad because we didn't get to revel in like the cool moment that we just saw, right? Like, we didn't get a chance to really enjoy and really appreciate how cool of a moment that was. So that obviously would have been fun, but we were all racing to the airport. I think Wayno had already, his flight had already gone. He had no shot. But like, our statistician Ed Sfida, myself, Tom Verducci now has to get ready to go to Toronto. AJ is trying to catch a red eye flight. So we're all kind of hustling to the airport and we only get to enjoy that car ride to SeaTac to be able to say what a cool moment that was. I had phone calls, I had text messages from, again, friends, broadcasters, my girlfriend, like just everybody that was watching this game that maybe even didn't have a vested interest in the teams or the sport itself. This felt like one of those things one of those sporting events that kind of transcends normal fandom, because you're getting people who are coming home from dinner and they're like, all right, let me watch something for 30 minutes and then go to bed. And then they get hooked in the 12th inning, or they fall asleep on their couch during the eighth and they wake up and it's the 12th. And they're like, oh my God, this game is still going on. I'm awake now. Let me watch this. It was just one of those nights. So it was hard to get to sleep. I landed in Charlotte at about 8 a.m. on Saturday. I tried to sit down in my hotel room as soon as I got there and lock in and work and go back to the prep process, which I still had to play a little bit of catch up, and I couldn't focus. So I took another nap for like an hour and a half and just tried to kind of get back into the mode. And then I was able to work the rest of the day. We went to our production meeting and went over the broadcast for the next day. And then the game happens and you never know what type of game you're going to get. And we were so fortunate that we got a fun, entertaining back and forth game down to the wire, walk off field goal, huge win for Carolina. The Panthers are playing well. We're doing Carolina Buffalo on Sunday coming up. So like they've got momentum now and they're over 500. Buffalo is in a dogfight with New England in the AFC East in the first half of the year. So it suddenly has some greater stakes to it. You never know what kind of games you're going to get. You just try to stay dialed in, prepared, locked in, focused. You lean on the people next to you. You lean on the people in the truck. And hopefully you get a game like that, and hopefully you deliver in the moment. So to have a weekend like that is something every broadcaster hopes for, dreams of, wishes for, prays for, whatever it may be. And one of the texts I got on Friday before the game five was from Mike Tirico. And in fact, it was a phone call too. And he said, you have the best job in sports this weekend, getting ready for a winner-take-all game, and then you're going to go call a Cowboy game. You know, you're going to call an NFL game on Sunday. It happens to be the Cowboys because of obviously the brand and all that stuff. This is like, you have the best job in sports this weekend. And it felt like I did by the end of Sunday's game.
You mentioned Mike Tirico, Adam, and I don't know if you noticed, but there are some similarities between your call of the Mariners clinching and Tirico's call back in 2014, I believe it was. Was Tirico sort of in your head a little bit there, Adam?
When Joe Davis, who's one of my good friends, won his sports Emmy for his outstanding work in the World Series, he shouted out Mike Tirico at the ceremony. And he said, I used to watch YouTube clips of you over and over and over again. And I laughed so much at that with this warm feeling in my heart, because that's what I would do. Like, that's part of the reason that I'm friends with who I'm friends with, because we all have similar mentalities about how we approach this business and who we watch and who we, you know, I've watched Sean McDonough's call of the 6 overtime game a million times. I've watched more. I imagine all of us in some form or fashion who are nerds for this, who love the history of this, who love great calls, who model ourselves after whoever it is that we might admire in whatever fashion of the business we do. Like, Mike is one of the people I admire the most. And I've listened to that Damian Lillard. He got the shot off. Lillard good. It's good. And the Blazers win the series for the first time in 14 years with the staccato finish to it. I've listened to that call dozens of times, as I have with so many of the people that I look up to. I just listened over and over and over. And I think it's probably, it was just embedded somewhere in my head where, like, in that moment, the rhythm of the moment felt right. And it probably just reverted back to, remember that call you've listened to so many times? I don't doubt that that was in the back of my head in some form or fashion. And the fact that he had called me that day, and he was fresh in my head as just my friend and my colleague and a person I respect and appreciate, I don't doubt that that was somewhere in the back of my head, and it happened to come out in this kind of organic, perfect, rhythmic moment to cap off that type of sporting event. I think that was part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think for sure, I know I've said this, I can always hear a little bit of Mike Tirico in your cadences. I'm pretty sure you've said, off we go, because that's a Tiricoism, and I know I've heard you say that before. Is Mike your biggest influence, or are you kind of, the term that I think I like to use is, you are a river? That comes from a Mark Zumoff book that he wrote about broadcasting. And basically, you are a river kind of picking up all of these various things from different broadcasters. Is it more along those lines?
It is absolutely along those lines. Mark said it beautifully. And Mark is a great teacher to a lot of young broadcasters, and has been for a lot of young broadcasters over the years. He's been a longtime voice of the 76ers and a great influence on a lot of people. I think when we first start doing this job, and I tell this to students now, and I tell this to young broadcasters now, like, be a critical listener and viewer. Like, watch who you respect or watch who you like. At some point in your life, you got it. If you're into this business or you want to get into this business, that means at some point in your life, you heard somebody say something during a thing that you were looking at, and your brain connected the picture that you were seeing and the sounds that you were hearing and said, that feels good in my head. That sounds right. That looks right. My heartbeat changed because of the things that I'm viscerally experiencing right now. That's like just a human thing. So you decided, well, I would like to hear more of that. I would like to do that. I would like to be the person that narrates that for somebody else. And when you don't really have an idea how to do it, you just know it's been done before. You watch, you listen to the people that are closest to you. So if you live in Chicago, you probably listen to Pat Hughes or Pat Foley or Jim Durham, if you're a little older than me. And like for me, it was Neil Funk and it was Wayne Larrivee. And, you know, there's a lot of guys that I just listened to because they were on the TV, they were on the radio, and that's who were my influences. I think when you start to get into the business side of it or the student, you know, you get into the craft side of it and you're a student of it, you start to listen critically and with an eye and ear for the thing that might appeal to you based on your own personality, because you're probably going to gravitate towards the things that fits your personality. I've always appreciated Mike, going back to when I really first started listening to him critically was when he became one of the voices of the NBA Finals on ESPN Radio. And I still have in a shoebox in my office a collection of cassette tapes, like audio cassette tapes. And I sound old as hell right now, and I get that, but that's okay. It's the stuff that like I would put my radio on, I would hit play and record on the cassette tape at the same time and just record Jim Durham, Mike Tirico, Kevin Calabro doing the NBA playoffs and the NBA Finals, Mark Kestisher hosting the studio show, which taught me how to host and create a studio show when I was a college student. Listening to John Miller and Dan Shulman do the playoffs on ESPN Radio, Gary Thorne do Sunday Night Baseball. And I have all these cassette tapes and I would listen to them over and over again. And a lot of them just happened to be Tirico because he was calling big basketball games and I was getting an opportunity to call basketball in college. So there is no doubt that most of my style from radio basketball came from Mike. A lot of it came from Jim Durham. A lot of it came from Kevin Calabro, but Mike was the guy that I probably emulated the most because he did some things that were a little different, whether it was an extra descriptor, whether it was a way to cap a call, which again, we just talked about how good he has been his whole career at capping these big calls. I don't doubt that that is a major influence on me. When I first started doing television college basketball, I went back and just would find Sean McDonough's six overtime call, you know, the Syracuse game. And it's not just the calls, it's the cadence. It's exactly what you said, John. It's you pick up on little ticks, on little rhythms, on little words, vocabulary. A lot of this stuff, I think Mark said it perfectly. You are a river. You just pick up what is in front of you, what appeals to you, what vibes with you, with your personality, with your ability to storytell or whatever it may be. Like you pick up the things that you can do in your voice. And everybody sounds like they're imitating somebody. I sounded like I was imitating Matt Vasgersian when I first started doing minor league baseball games. I was imitating the first partner that I ever had on baseball games when I first started because I didn't know how to do this and I didn't have a voice and I didn't have an identity. And I think that's what everybody in any business, any industry, any artistic venture, and certainly in what we do in the play-by-play side, like we're all just trying to figure out a blueprint for how to do this, but how to make it our own. And for me, it only came with time and reps and listening critically and watching critically and filtering out the stuff that I can't do. I can't do what Mark Jones does. I love what Mark Jones is able to do with the vocabulary he uses. He's told me about family members of his that drilled it into his head to be somebody that speaks with variety and with vocabulary. And I listen to him on NBA games and I go, it's awesome to listen to. I can't emulate that because it would sound forced. So I want to make sure that I appreciate it, but it doesn't work for me. It's not something I would do without sounding like it's inauthentic. So the stuff that I've said over the years or whatever has come out now after 15 years of doing this, it's all from little bits and pieces of everybody that you like and respect and appreciate and love listening to and watching, and eventually becomes a little bit more of an amalgamation, which becomes your own identity and your own voice.
How far back do you go? Because obviously you listen to the people you grew up with, but you know, I could go on YouTube. Marv Albert's call from the 1970 Finals Game 7 is on YouTube. Do you listen back to people from before your time?
I listen to a lot of Jim Durham because there are still YouTube videos of the NBC broadcast with his call layered over it from the 91 finals when the Bulls won their first title. And I would go back and listen to that a bunch because Jim, to me, is still the best basketball radio play-by-play announcer ever. And it's because of his economy. And that's a weird thing to say because we're always taught you have to be more descriptive. And you do. It was how economical he was without you not losing the picture in your head. And I thought, that's incredible. Now, he also had this great voice, this resonant, some nasal, but a lot of depth. I think Jim may have been a smoker or something like that too. Like, I don't know that for sure, but like it, whatever all these experiences in his life that created his voice, it worked so well with his rhythm, his economy of words. I listen to Kevin Calabro and it's a completely different style. I go back and I wish I remember exactly what game it is, but Kevin Calabro used to simulcast the games for the Seattle Supersonics, right? It would be the radio call layered over the TV call. So he had to be a little judicious. Like, he didn't want to make it sound completely like a radio call, but he also would add something to the TV call that you weren't going to get anywhere else because of the simulcast nature of it. And it's a playoff game, and he is calling every touch like there's 6 seconds left in game 7 of the finals. And it's one of the most remarkable pieces of basketball broadcasting I've ever heard. And after the shot goes down, he goes, "That's how you do it. 7-6 ball game," or something like that. The score, it's like the first 6 minutes of the game. And it's one of the most remarkable things I've ever heard.
Michael hands off to Payton, up fake, drives the slower Ellis into the lane. Turns the corner, stops. In midair, gives off to Kemp. He juggles it, got it, hooks it up, missed it. Rebound, Cage, battling with Ellis. Saved inbounds by Payton. Right to Kemp, beneath the lid, stutter step. In he comes, blocked, got it back, hooks it up, no. Rebound, Kendall up, no. Blocked by Williams, grabbed by Kemp. In the lane, following jumper, blocked by Williams. Outside to McMillan. Cross court to Gary for the three. Yes! The way you get it done. 11-6 ball game.
And I remember going back to that and just going, there's so much stuff in there that I could try. None of it's going to work for me because Kevin is another unique one-of-one type of broadcaster. He just is. There's nobody like him in the NBA working now and for as long as I've been listening. So, you know, kind of going back to the 90s is where I go. I don't go too much further back from that. I do think the style has changed. I think television broadcasts have changed because you do have a full graphics package that gives you so much of the information that a lot of the TV guys had to give. Like, there were times where you wouldn't know what the count was until they flashed it right before the next pitch, then they took it off because you had to go back and update it again for the next pitch. It didn't happen automatically the way it does sometimes now with the next level of digital broadcast that we have. So that's about as far back as I go, but there's 15, 20 announcers that I could go back and listen to from the last 30, 35 years and pick something up from one of them and go, that's still applicable today. Is that something that I feel like I would want to implement? I do a lot less of that now because I feel like I am who I am or I'm becoming who I am and I'm going to be. But I think there is always something you can learn going back as far as you possibly can.
Adam, sports media is aware of the Mark Sanchez news, and we're not going to ask you to offer an opinion on that, but how does it affect you? You were his primary partner. This was your second year together. How does it affect your preparation for the rest of the season?
I think I just try to do the job the same way. You know, I hope that anybody I've worked with, and I've worked with, I think, something close to 150 to 170 different analysts in my career. With all the sports I used to do at ESPN, I worked a lot of sports. I worked with a lot of different great analysts. I work with multiple baseball partners, multiple football partners, because I fill in for Joe Davis now with Greg Olson and then go back to the normal crew. I feel like my job is just to be as prepared as possible. And whoever is standing next to me, I want to do my best to make them look good. So whoever it might end up being, and I honestly don't know yet, and I have little opinion on what should happen, I will be happy with whoever they put with me. And if it's somebody standing next to me that needs this, I'll help them out with whatever I've prepared. If they need that, I'll help them out with whatever that may be. My job is to make it as easy as possible for producer, director, graphics, analyst, reporter, and for a fan trying to contextualize whatever it is that we're talking about. So I don't think for me personally, it's supposed to change. I think you're supposed to prepare it the same way, be as thorough as possible so that you can pick up any crumb that anybody leaves and be able to back them up on it. So that has to be the approach no matter what.
Okay, I got to ask this because I'm curious. Your favorite Adam Amin call, is it the Ogunbowale clincher or is it the Mariners Game 5 clincher or something else?
I think there are two inflection points of a career when you can look back 15 years and go, man, we got to do some really, really ridiculously cool, fun, awesome stuff. I'm sure I might be a victim of recency bias. I just think the nature of that game, the fact that it was 5 hours, the fact that it was as intense as it was, you know, baseball is the sport I grew up on. It was the first sport that I really worked in professionally. It's the sport that I grew up on with my father and my brother. Like, it's the sport that means probably the most to me from a professional and personal standpoint. So it's hard for me not to look at that game and think that was maybe the coolest thing I've ever had the opportunity to be a small part of. It's hard for me not to look at it that way. That's exactly how I felt after the Ogunbowale call in, you know, 7.5 years ago. The way people reacted to it because of the nature of the game, not necessarily about what we did, but because of the nature of the game and getting to be there for it. That's how I felt then, because that was another one of those nights where I had a phone full of text messages and voicemails and DMs saying, like, I can't believe what we just saw. Like, I can't believe you got a chance to be there for that. What a game. What a moment. And it's hard for me not to look at what we saw in Seattle for that game 5 and not think that that's maybe the coolest thing I've ever, maybe will ever get a chance to be a part of.
And that is the most watched game of the playoffs so far. We're taping Monday, so game 7 of the Mariners and Blue Jays is happening tonight. Maybe you would think that would do better, but given the Monday Night Football competition, it might not, actually. So it's an interesting thing. You were in the most watched game of the playoffs and possibly the most watched individual broadcast you've ever done for that Mariners-Tigers game. Are you ever cognizant at all when you're doing a really big game of the size of the audience that's watching, or is that just not ever something that comes to your mind?
I don't think that's ever really come to my mind in the moment. It's just so far away from anything that we have to focus on. It's not something that has ever really occurred to me in the moment. Afterwards, sure, because, you know, a couple days go by and certainly anybody on the PR staff might say, hey, we got a great number for this, or like, we're expecting a big number. That's cool. But I remember like listening to Jim Nance talk about this once back in the day. And I think this was on like the BS Report, which was Bill Simmons's podcast way back in the day, like the late 2000s, early 2010s. I remember listening to an episode and it was with Jim Nance. And I think he brought something up along those lines. And Nance said, listen, I don't care really. Like, hey, am I happy for the company? And like, does it make their job and their life a little easier? Great. That's awesome. But it has so little to do with what we're focused on a game-to-game basis, especially if somebody like Nance, you know, I've taken this mentality. Ian Eagles, one of the mentors in my career, he's always told me and pushed me on this mentality, like, you're only as good as the next one and as good as the audience might have been for this. And I've done a Cowboy Giant game that got something like 15, 16 million people watching. I've done, you know, this. I've had very fortunate to just have big audiences, especially when you do the NFL and people join your game and now 20 million people are watching you for an hour. Like, that happens once in a while, but that's so far removed from our heads in the moment. And the mentality that all those guys have talked about or pushed personally onto me is, you're only as good as the next thing you do. Like, the next thing is the one that matters. Once that's over, enjoy it, appreciate it, try to contextualize it if you can, but the next thing is the big thing. And that's always the most important thing.
Over the years outside of sports, you have another hobby, and that's DJing. Where did this come from, and what makes you want to continue it, despite being very busy on the sports side of things?
I was 13 years old. I got a B96 Mixmaster Throwdown CD for my birthday from a friend of mine. That is a very specific Chicago reference that I think anybody who listens to this that's from Chicago will appreciate. And if you're from Chicago, you listen to house music, you've heard it, it's popped up in your feed and your radio on, not, you know, modern time, like, it just pops up. You will hear house music if you live in Chicago. And I got hooked to it immediately. Like, I had never heard anything like that. And as a teenager, you're so easily influenced by new stuff that you're hearing musically for the first time. And that was one of the things that influenced me right away. And I listened to it and wore out that CD, and my brother realized that. And so he got me a pair of turntables and a mixer for my birthday. And this is like full turntables. I had to go to record shops, buy records, buy vinyl records, learn to mix them without the technology that's so readily available to people now. And I think that's why DJing is probably blown up so much in the last years. It's not hard to do with the technology that helps you, but I had to learn all these skills of doing it without all that technology. And then you get learn how to use the next iteration of it. And I did it for years. I did it professionally for a while. I did friends of mine's weddings. I did corporate events. I did bar mitzvahs. I did school stuff like in high school at the cafeteria. And it just became something I did all the way through my job in Iowa when we'd go out and do these events. Like I had to do it. I stopped doing it at 24 when I got hired by ESPN. I had to set my focus on my career. And then a few years ago, I was like, I've got some time. I've got some resources. I've got this creative itch in my head. I would love to get back to doing something with music. And I was like, all right, let's try this. Let's go back to it. It's the music that I've always appreciated. I still listen to. Let's give it a shot. And I had enough connections with people in the city that they were like, well, yeah, you're kind of a novelty. Let's get the Bulls guy to come out and DJ at our club or something. I'm sure that'll go over well. And it went well. And people were like, do you want to do another event? I said, yeah, sure. And they were like, do you want to play at this club? And I'm like, I would love to play at this club. And eventually it was, do you want to play this festival of ours? And I said, I'd love to play this festival of yours. So it just became something that kept growing the last 2.5 years. And, you know, it's less so right now, but when we get back into the flow of just kind of doing the NBA, yeah, we'll get back to doing a little bit more. I'm doing an event on Halloween night after a Bulls game in Chicago before I travel the next day to wherever our NFL game is. So yeah, we're still trying to enjoy it as much as we can. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do and share with people.
What parallels to play-by-play announcing can you kind of draw with DJing?
There is preparation involved. I DJ in a way that is really like trick heavy. I use 3 decks at home. I have a sampler I use. I scratch. That's just how I grew up on it. And I know a lot of like younger DJs like don't necessarily like all that stuff. So I find creative ways to do it. So there is for me preparation involved where it's combining different points of songs and trying to make it sound like something you haven't heard rather than just playing a song at a certain speed, mixing in and blending in another song at a certain speed. I like to chop things up and use vocals from different songs and different eras and different genres and try to slam in a sample that people weren't expecting in that moment, but they're familiar with. And now it combines with something else. I try to do this as creatively as I can, because to me, otherwise, what's the point? I don't get the rush of it from just playing song after song. Even if the songs are good and the crowd likes it, I want to give them something a little bit different because that's how I did it when I was younger. So there is still an element of preparation involved. And it's reading the moment. It's reading the room. I don't want to script anything. You know, when it comes to calls, I don't think about it that way. I think about things that may be important, like we did with the Polanco play. Like, hey, as a reminder, this is what's important now. So let's try to come up with something that incorporates those things. But it's never about scripting it. It's about having an idea and then seeing what the moment requires of you. And I think that's something that you do in music and DJing and performing. Is the crowd liking this? All right, well, let's lean into that a little bit and give them something of a different iteration that they might like. If this isn't working, all right, let's pivot to something that they're more familiar with that might appeal to them. So I think that's the biggest parallel I can draw between the two disciplines.
All right, Adam, congratulations on all your success and looking forward to hearing you on the Bulls and, of course, more National Football League games. And then next season, more Major League Baseball games as well. And of course, you'll be doing the game in Berlin, as you said. So safe travels there. And maybe one of these days you'll get to put a little bit of the NFL on Fox, the theme music, into the DJing.
It's a good way to toss that in there. I think we're going to have to figure something out at some point, man.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that interview with Adam Amin. I want to thank Adam Amin for taking the time to speak with us. I want to thank Armand. I want to thank Derek. And I want to thank all of you for listening as well. We'll be back with more stuff very soon.